When I was a kid, one of the things that we always did in our family was we went off to summer camp. And summer camp was always fun. We went to summer camp called Mount Cross Lutheran Camp. It was up in Santa Cruz. I always did the more rugged of the things. I don't know if you did. Denise, you went to music camp. Denise always went to a beach camp. Yeah, so she would go to this camp, and then they would drive down the mountains into Santa Cruz and spend all day at the beach. And I'm thinking to myself, that's not... Anyway, I loved the camp that we had always gone to, and I remember when we would take pictures, and the best part was you would get home, you would start developing these pictures. And I remember one summer, it's still totally ingrained in my brain, the friends that I made at that summer camp were unlike any other friends that I had ever met. We genuinely, in those 5 days, got to know each other so well. And even to this day, when I pull out pictures and I look at that, I don't remember a lot of the details, but I remember the feelings I got from going to that camp. Being nostalgic is something that I think all of us feel from time to time. Just the other day, Joshua was being nostalgic with us. And you're like, how can a freshman in high school become nostalgic? Don't you have to get a couple of years on you before you become nostalgic? Not Joshua. He was remembering fondly the times at Crescent Elementary School. I think he was actually fondly remembering the times that he didn't have homework. And, you know, the high school load starts getting... And I'm like, you just wait until you then get out and other things. You'll be nostalgic for the high school days. And then you'll be nostalgic for the college days. Is it good to be nostalgic? Is it good to relive the glory days? Yeah, you know, so we have a little bit of... So we have some that say yes, some that a little bit maybe. When does reliving the glory days become a negative? Okay, when it consumes you, when you think everything, you're always living at that time, not in the present. Okay, good. What else? When it prevents you from moving forward, right? Yeah, yeah. What's again the most famous phrase we hear in churches that becomes so nostalgic that they never move forward? Our favorite phrase, well, we've never done it that way, right? Right, when someone says we've never done it that way, they're being nostalgic, and that which was in the past becomes a prevention of something good in the future. Tradition. Traditions can be good. I think we've talked about that. They can also be bad if they prevent certain things. When else is nostalgic bad? I think we hinted at it, and this is something that I think we all got to be careful of. When the comparison of the idealistic past makes us depressed about our current situation. That was a mouthful. When the idealized past depresses us in the current situation. Like I said, I don't remember much about that summer camp, but I do remember a few things that were bad about it. I remembered that I got sick. And I got sick because we had a water drinking contest to see how much water you could... Now, I know it's deadly now, but this is back in the day before all these safety regulations. But yeah, I remember I took a 2 liter of water and I just started drinking. I drank the whole 2 liters of water. And then my body promptly said, that's too much water, and out came about 2 liters of water mixed with other things. I remember sleeping at night, not feeling very good. I remember waking up one morning, and on my arm were these bumps after we had hiked through the mountains a little bit. Yeah, I was freaking out until the camp counselor came over, looked at it, started rubbing it, and it was just peanut butter. So it was, you know... I was fine, but I remember these things that I've idealized the past and have forgotten some of the bad things, and it prevents me from living in the now. 1 Chronicles 18 is going to be a bit nostalgic. And it's also nostalgic in the way that it often forgets the bad stuff. I'll throw in the bad stuff that 1 Chronicles doesn't throw in just for the fun of it that we get from 2 Samuel chapter 8. This is actually a parallel passage, and it's interesting when you go, gosh, what was said and what was not said? With 1 Chronicles, you have to remember again the reason why this stuff was written. At this point in the Israelite history, they are in captivity. What would happen in those days is if a conquering nation came in and captured you, one way that they would try to prevent you from becoming a powerhouse again is they would take you physically and you would have to live in the foreign land. So again, if Iceland came to invade America and captured and conquered us, they would deport us all into Iceland and we would have to live as Icelanders. I don't know what the Icelandic people, Icelanders. And we would have to learn all of what it means to become a person in Iceland. And usually what would happen is conquered nations would long for their motherland. This is what the Israelites were facing. They had been taken away into Babylon, and they were sitting around wondering, had God forgotten about us? And God brings to mind to them some of the glory days. And you got to ask the question, why is God doing it? Again, is God doing this to be like, oh, hey, you remember the good old days when things were actually really good? I don't think that's how God operates. He's doing this to show them once again who he is, the promises he makes, and the presence he's always going to have with them. Like, I will always be with you. So as we read through this, you're going to be like, wow, this sounds like all the good stuff. And it is. It's all the good stuff. 1 Chronicles 18.
Isn't this post-return? This was written after the return.
It was written either in the exile or after they had returned into the land. Yeah. The material we're reading happened a lot earlier.
It was written after they had returned.
Yeah, so these people are trying to figure out, you know, and again,
you were saying during the exile. Oh,
I'm sorry, yes. While they're in the exile, they're struggling. As they're returning and they're trying to figure out what was our history, again, how hard it is to go, well, I remember the good old days, which is how some people take this. But again, I think that God is doing something different, saying, I want you to remember that, but not for the purpose of getting stuck as we talked. Correct, yeah. And again, they had big struggles when they're rebuilding the temple because one of their big problems was this temple doesn't look as good as Solomon's temple. And they all started crying. And half of them were crying like, the young people were like, hey, this is great. We've got a church because we're now finally, you know, out and we got this. And then the old timers were like, this is horrible because this was not as good as what we had in the past. And that's a glory day issue. So we've got to figure out for us how to properly relive the glory days. Because I do agree that I think there are times we need to look back in order to understand God's patterns. God has a certain pattern, and when we can follow that, we can go, I know what God will do for me in my life because of what he's done in the past. In the course of time, David defeated the Philistines and then subdued them, and he took Gath and its surrounding villages from the control of the Philistines. It's so tough. It's this, one of the biggest enemies they had were the Philistines. They always were battling them. And the Philistines hated the Israelites. The Israelites hated the Philistines. And in one quick verse, the Israelites won. And again, for someone trying to settle back in land, trying to wonder, where is God? Has he abandoned us? God is bringing to mind saying, you got to remember that I was with David to the point where the greatest enemy he ever faced, he conquered. That's David. And then David also defeated the Moabites, and they became subject to him, and brought tribute. Moreover, David fought Hadadezer, king of Zobah, as far as Hamath, when he went to establish his control along the Euphrates River. David captured 1,000 of his chariots, 7,000 charioteers, and 20,000 foot soldiers. Mari, can you plug your ears on this next verse? It's a sad verse, and then he hamstrung all but 100 of the chariot horses. You're like, what did he do to all these horses? He severed the hamstring so they couldn't run properly. So thousands of horses got hamstrung. Yeah, charioteers are kind of like the musketeers. Exactly, yeah. We always get tough stuff like this. I'm going to address it, and then I'm going to bring us back to verses 3 and 4 because there's important stuff going on there. Why did David hamstring all but 100 of the chariot horses? Because that was what he needed to do to remain humble before God. Again, back in those days, horses were not beloved animals that we, you know, honor and respect as we do to this day. They were simply just a function of usually a war machine. And if you had lots of horses, you would start becoming arrogant in your strength and ability. So one way that he prevented it was, I'm going to take out these horses, not multiply them to myself so that I think that I am stronger than I actually am. So it's tough, but it was actually his way of obeying God's word. This is a lot like what we do nowadays. Certain rules will follow to the T, certain rules we won't. David was told two specific things as king, that you don't multiply these two things. You don't multiply horses, and you don't multiply wives. So he didn't multiply horses, and he thought, this works, I'm at least following something. And I chuckle at that because it's easy to say, well, David, you messed up on the wives issue. But again, David is so much like us. There are certain rules that we will follow as Christians, and even individual Christians, where we go, this is what I believe, and this is how I'm going to live it. And we get shocked when other people don't follow the rule the way we follow the rule, but they may follow a different rule, and they look at us and go, well, why don't you follow this rule? And we see this all the time. The best Christians are those that simply stay humble and say, we're all just a bunch of screw-ups, and we all need to remain humble, and some do things better than others, but I'm not going to sit here and throw a bunch of stones and become really angry at other people because they don't follow the particular rule I wish for them to follow. Some people are big on cussing, and so you don't cuss. And if you cuss, you must be a bad Christian. Some are like, well, if you make a mistake, like smoke marijuana, okay, that's bad. But for some, it becomes like the death knell to your Christianity. You must not be a Christian because you did this sin. For all of us, David, don't multiply wives, don't multiply horses. He did the horse thing. He didn't do the wife thing. Ended up with too many wives. How many is too many wives? More than one. It's just a rule. Just follow that. Yeah. More than your current wife. Yes, yeah. Yeah, just verifying that you got it correct. Yes. You can just give him a good elbow there, Kelly. So again, as he's, verses 1 through 4, it's this huge thing where they're remembering back this incredible fight that David had. And again, it's idealized. Because one of the things that's missing in this is when he captured one of these groups, he thinned them out a little bit. And he did it through lengths of cord. So he'd line them all up, and he would have this cord. And he'd do one length of cord, kill him. One length of cord, kill him. One length of cord, he lives. One length of cord, kill him. Kill him. Third one, he lives. I would think that by the end, people would be like, that's what I would think. You know, it's a schoolyard pick. Like, oh, I want to get on that team. I'm going to adjust. Idealized, because this wasn't, again, the purpose of this material was to provide encouragement. it was help them say, the stuff you're going through now, look at what God has done in the past. Becoming nostalgic about what God has done in the past is supposed to give you encouragement for this day, not depress you because the idealized past is no longer in play. So that's why he did all this. Verse 5, then we get a bunch of alliances that happen. Yeah, it's always tough when I play Monopoly. No one likes to play Monopoly with me, and I don't know why. No, I don't cheat. I just always win. It's amazing. It's, yeah, losers normally say that I cheat, and so that's how it... yeah, okay, and it's funny because what will happen is as I start playing, what do you always do to the top dog? Take him to, and you get alliances with other people so that you could try and take out the top dog. This is what's actually happening in verse 5. A group, when the Arameans of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David struck down 22,000 of them. He put garrisons in the Aramean kingdom of Damascus, and the Arameans became subject to him and brought tribute. The Lord gave David victory everywhere he went. I mean, that's a pretty bold statement. Everything David did, he won at. Even when people tried to gang up, even when alliances were formed, like let's march in and take out David, David still won. Again, is battle difficult? Are fights challenging? Were there losses? Were there struggles? Yeah, but everything here is idealized. Again, be careful. When you idealize the past, that it causes you to become frozen because you are upset at your current situation. Verse 7, David took the gold shields carried by the officers of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. This may be an indication of why these people, the officers of Hadadezer, why they lost so badly. Does gold, are shields made of gold? Are those good shields? No. You know, they're great if you want to, you know, redeem them for, you know, cash or something like that at the corner drugstore. But a gold shield, if you took a sword and whacked that gold shield, what's going to happen? It's going to break or it's going to bend in half. Some people are like, oh, these were ceremonial shields. And yeah, maybe they could be. If that's the case, then the officers weren't even fighting in the battle. So there's all sorts of mess up here. Yeah, Josh? Yes, so if you play Minecraft, all you nerdy Minecraft people, gold breaks easily. Very good. What would you rather have? What do you? Diamonds. I want a diamond shield from here on out. Diamond encrusted shield. That would be fabulous. Fabulous. So David took the gold shields carried by the officers of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem from Tebah and Kun towns that belonged to Hadadezer. David took a great quantity of bronze, which Solomon used to make the bronze sea, the pillars, and various bronze artifacts. Again, this is, we talked a little bit about this last week. What's happening is David wanted to build the house, and God says, no, you're not going to build me a house. I'm going to build you a house. And so David said, fine, I'll prepay for everything. So in David's conquest of all these things, he was amassing these massive amounts of treasure for one purpose and one purpose only, for God. And that's a pretty cool thing. As he was capturing all these artifacts, he was putting them not into his own private treasury, which he as king probably had every right to do so. Instead of lining his own coffers, he says, I want to use this somehow for God. And that's how the temple essentially got paid for, was all of the treasure that David amassed in these victories beforehand. Verse 9, when Tou, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated the entire army of Hadadezer, king of Zobah, he sent his son Hadoram to King David to greet him and congratulate him on his victory in battle over Hadadezer, who had been at war with Tou. Hadoram brought all kinds of articles of gold and silver and bronze. What's happening here? Well, it's like when I play Monopoly and soon someone realizes, well, either I'm going to be destroyed by Mark or I can join forces with him and then just destroy everyone else and at least I got second place. That's what this guy's doing. He's watching a whole army swept through, joined forces with another huge, gigantic army, and they went to attack Israel and they all lost. And so one group's standing back and they're like, what do you think we should do? I think we should send a peace delegation with a lot of money and let's go see if we can bribe David to not kill us. Not a bad strategy. actually. Does it work? Yes, it does. It's pretty incredible. As King David, he dedicates all these articles to the Lord as he had done with the silver and gold he had taken from all these nations. Edom and Moab, the Ammonites and the Philistines and Amalek. Again, idealized. Not much in terms of struggle and pain in these passages. The danger, again, you idealize the past, it may be helping you stay frozen in your current negative situation, which is never God's intent. Abishai, son of Zeruiah, struck down 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. I want Abishai on my team. He put garrisons in Edom, and all the Edomites became subject to David. The Lord gave David victory everywhere he went. So imagine that you are an Israelite reading this. You're back in the land. You've been carried off into captivity. You're now back. You're trying to rebuild, but it's not like the glory days. And then you sit down in church and someone pulls out 1 Chronicles and they're like, let's recount some of David's victories. How do you start feeling at this moment? For the Israelites, they used this to become more encouraged about the future. Back in 2001, there was a group of us that decided we would love to see what it would be like to start a brand new church called Searchlight Ministries. So on February 4th, 2001, we launched it. It's interesting because some of you have been with us from the beginning. And it becomes tempting because we go, oh, do you remember the glory days? The turquoise walls. Oh, it was just so fantastic. And we start thinking about how good things were back then. We had this ultimate freedom. We could do whatever we wanted. And I did it for the very first time. I did not wear a tie to church on that February 4th. I felt so good. And we didn't have to worry about people saying, well, that's not how we do things here. But it's interesting when I actually look back, I also know that there were struggles. We had struggles of finances that a lot of people didn't really even realize. I remember the first time, about a month into it, I went to the offering boxes that we had mounted on the back, and I opened up the offering boxes and I pulled out a whopping $32 for the offering that Sunday. Now, granted, we were in a facility in a space that we had to pay $4,280 every single month for rent. Well, $32... that ain't going to cover no rent. I was supposed to be receiving a salary. Chris Houston was supposed to be receiving a salary. Let me tell you, no one got paid that day. And I remember as we went through this, as I look back now, what I'm seeing is the establishment of God's patterns. There are times with Heather and I that we often look at our finances and we think to ourselves, I don't know how we're going to make it. But then we look back. And we look back to days when we were receiving about $30,000 a year with three kids and a mortgage, lots of other bills. Do you know what God did through all of that? He kept us. He got us through it. I'm shocked. Every time I look back, I often wonder. I'm a numbers guy. I plan things. I budget things. How did we make it through? And I can tell you, without a shadow of a doubt, that was God keeping us through that. I don't know why I still have struggles when it comes to being worried about the future and finances. Because every time I've seen God work, it is always, his pattern is always to preserve. Amazes me. I think of all the changes that Searchlight has gone throughout the years. Different things that have happened. Different moves that's taken place. Different staff members that have come on board. Different worship leaders that have taken the helm. And I look back and I can sometimes maybe say, gosh, I really liked it when this person was leading worship. I really liked it when this person was leading worship. And as I go through it, I see a pattern of God's preserving. That whatever happened, whoever was there, God preserved. He established himself as being truthful and honest by saying, this is how I'm going to take care of you. Why do we study things like this? Why do we sit back and remember the glory days? It's for this one important thing. Because we can all get stuck in our own situation, become depressed about our own circumstances, to the point that we forget what God has already done in the past. Some of you may be battling some really difficult stuff. Maybe it's financial. Maybe it's relational. Maybe you're having struggles with your parents, struggles with your kids. Maybe your job is totally out of whack and you don't know what to do. Maybe you just have a really nasty neighbor. Maybe you're having struggles with longtime friends. And I'm going to tell you of God's perseverance. I'm going to tell you a story of what God has promised to do for you. That promise began several thousand years ago, when God decided to break into this world. When he said, I love these people so much, I think I'm going to go down there and be with them. And because of this promise he kept to come into the world, he started developing these incredible relationships with people. But relationships with people weren't enough, because the problem is people are bad. And people do stupid things. And though they've had a long history of God's preservation, they started forgetting. And when you start forgetting what God has done for you in the past, you become stuck in your circumstances and you will be unable to move forward. And so Jesus started talking to them about other things. And even that wasn't enough, because teachings are great. Telling someone that they love them is good. But let's face it, it's really just not enough. And so Jesus started performing miracles, and he was saying, let me demonstrate this love. Let me show you my power. Let me show you who I am as God. And people saw that. Some were wowed by it. Some were unimpressed. So why do we read about miracles for us? Why do we keep going back to them? Because it's establishing a pattern of who God is. But miracles are not enough. Changing water into wine, having blind men see, having mute people talk is great, but it's not enough. And that's when the ultimate act of love took place. We remember back to what Jesus did when he said, I will be willing to lay down my life. You must consider what that means. We finally figured it out a little bit more in our family when this past Easter, we sat the boys down, though it was really late at night, and we had them watch The Passion of the Christ. And it was tough watching that. If you've ever watched The Passion of the Christ, it's a very challenging movie to get through. And afterwards, both boys, Mark Thomas was asleep. I don't think he could have handled it. Jake and Josh looked at us and said, we didn't understand that that's what it meant. When we say Jesus died on the cross, it's not some cliche, it's not some quick thing we say. It's actually something super important. And they've looked back now, and they've seen this is the pattern that God is establishing. My pattern is, I love you. I'm going to preserve you. When things are going bad in your life, I will maintain you through that. And ultimately, I will bring you out of it. That's why 1 Chronicles 18 was written. It's not just a reliving of the glory days. It's a reliving of the promises. I don't know what you're going through, and I'm sure everyone here, you guys are fabulous and wonderful because you often will email me or text me or talk to me about stuff going on in your life. And I know that it means a lot. Why you share that with someone like me is always a testimony of God's miracles. Because I get to hear and listen, but then the most amazing thing happens. I get to see God work even through the really bad stuff to something on the other side when things actually turn good. Because it's the pattern of preservation that God has established. When you read 1 Chronicles 18, it's simple to say, this doesn't pertain to me. Who cares about wars that happened a long time ago? It matters because God is here to encourage you. Whatever you happen to be facing, you will get through it. Even if it is the most heinous of things, such as cancer and near death, even if it's bad health, even if it's something that challenges your very life, God has said, you will get through it. It may take walking through the valley of the shadow of death, but ultimately you're going to make it. And if you don't die, then God says, I'm going to see you through that as well. And take the most painful of subjects, painful of things that's ever happened in your life. God says, there's victory ahead. And it's hard now, but I'm always going to be with you. Finish up with the last couple of verses. We talk about David's officials. I'm not going to spend much time on this. David reigned over all Israel, doing what was just and right for all his people. Again, this is the height of David's successes. Joab, son of Zeruiah, was over the army. Jehoshaphat, you like to jump. Jehoshaphat, son of Ahilud, was recorder, which was great. That doesn't mean he played that weird-looking flute, clarinet-looking thing. He was the rememberer. I love it. Zadok, son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, son of Abiathar, were priests. Shavsha was secretary. Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites and the Pelethites, and David's sons were chief officials at the king's side. Oh, let me tell you, nepotism's reigned for a long time, people. Oh, let's just have our kids become our cabinet members. Oh, it's happened a lot, even in the past. Everything else, though, is glossed over. Did you notice we skipped something that happened in all those wars? Stuff that I'm surprised 1 Chronicles doesn't include. That little encounter David had with a woman on a roof. Yeah, it's crazy. Now again, it's not to say that David does things wrong. Some of these things that are included, and especially when we hit chapter 21, David is going to commit the greatest sin, a sin greater than the sin of that he committed with Bathsheba, a greater sin than the sin of killing off his husband so he could be with her, a sin greater than lying to God himself. He's going to do something even more heinous. So it's not whitewashing the past so that we don't realize what sin David's committed, but it's a reminder. God is going to see you through some difficult and challenging stuff. What do you need to remember today? Remember the depth of love that God has for you. Remember that whatever circumstance you are in right now, God is with you. Like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are thrown into a fiery furnace, there's a fourth that comes alongside him, one like a son of the gods, fulfilling the promise that God had given the Israelites early on in their life, early on in their history, when he said, when you pass through the waters, I'm going to be with you. When you pass through the flames, I will accompany you. So whatever you are going through in your life, know that God is there with you. May this encouragement see us through our circumstances. May we relive the glory days of what God has done as he establishes the pattern promise to keep us as his own. Let's pray.